terror of her first crossing, surrounded by darkness, holding her breath and waiting to hear the shriek of the Volcra, the flap of their wings as they came seeking prey.
"They're listing left," she muttered to Nikolai, as the skiff surged forward over the sand.
"They're doing their best, Zoya."
"Their best won't keep them alive," she wanted to bark. "I watched my friends die on these sands. And the least these young dullards could do is learn to pilot a half-empty skiff across them." Saints, she hated being here. Nearly 3 years had passed since the destruction of the Fold. But a strange quiet remained at its borders. The stillness of a battleground where good soldiers had fallen. The glass skiffs the Darkling had used to enter the Fold had long since been plundered and picked apart, but the wreckage of other vessels lay scattered over the many miles of the Fold. Some people treated the snapped masts and broken hulls as shrines to the dead. But others had scavenged what they could from them, timber, canvas, whatever cargo the lost skiffs had carried. And yet as they traveled deeper into the gray sands, Zoya wondered if the reverent quiet at the edges of the unsea had been pure imagination, the ghosts of her past clouding her vision. Because as they journeyed farther west, the Fold came alive. Everywhere she looked, she saw altars dedicated to the Sun Saint. Ramshackle businesses had sprouted like pox over the sands. Inns and restaurants, chapels, peddlers selling holy cures, pieces of Alina's bones, pearls from her kokoshnik, scraps of her kefta. It made Zoya's skin crawl. "They've always liked us better dead," she said. "No one knows what to do with a living saint." But Nikolai's gaze was trained on the horizon.
"What is that?"
Far ahead, Zoya could see a dark blot. It looked like a shadow cast by a bank of heavy cloud. But the sky above was clear. "A lake?"
"No," said Yuri. "A miracle."
Zoya considered pushing him over the railing.
"If I pointed to a leaky faucet, you'd say it was a miracle."
Yet as they drew closer, Zoya saw the shape on the horizon was not a body of water, but a gleaming black disk of stone, at least a mile across, perfectly round and shiny as a mirror. A rattletrap village of tents and makeshift shelters had grown up around the stone circle. There were no signs of the Sun Saint here, no golden icons or images of Alina with her white hair and antler collar. Zoya saw only black banners painted with the two circles representing the sun in eclipse. The Darkling's symbol.
"This is the place where the Starless One fell," said Yuri, reverence in his voice.
Was it? Zoya couldn't be sure. The battle was a memory of violent flames and fear, Harshaw bleeding on the ground, the skies full of Volcra.
"Centuries before," Yuri continued, "the Starless One stood on this very spot and challenged the rules that bound the universe. Only he dared to try to recreate the experiments of the bonesmith, Ilya Moritzova. Only he looked to the stars and demanded more."
"He dared," said Zoya.
"And the result of his failure was a tear in the world."
"The Shadowfold," said Nikolai. "The one place where his power became meaningless."
"The saints do love a bit of dramatic irony."
Zoya cut her hand through the air in irritation.
"Not the saints. This was no divine retribution."
Yuri turned pleading eyes upon her.
"How can you be sure? How can you know that the Fold was not a challenge the saint set before the Darkling?"
"You said it yourself. He defied the rules that bind the universe, that govern our power. He violated the natural order."
"But who created the natural order?" insisted Yuri. "Who is responsible for the making at the heart of the world?"
How she envied this boy's certainty, his visions, his ridiculous belief that pain had a purpose, that the saints had some kind of plan.
"Why does it have to be a who?" demanded Zoya.
"Maybe this is simply how the world functions, how it works.
What matters is that when Grisha overreach their power, there is a price. The lesson is built into all our stories, even the tales told to little Otkazatsya children like you.
Yuri shook his head stubbornly.
The Black Heretic chose this place with care. There has to be a reason. Maybe he liked the view, she shot back.
Still, said Nikolai. She planted her hands on her hips.
Not you too. There are places like this all over Ravka, he said, voice placating. Places that have served old gods and new saints. That have been built and ruined and rebuilt because people return to them again and again to worship.
Nikolai shrugged.
Perhaps they're drawn to power.
Or good weather, or cheap building materials, Zoya said in exasperation. She'd had about enough. As soon as the skiff came to a halt, she leapt from the railing.
Make sure Yuri stays here, she heard Nikolai instruct the twins as he jumped down after her. Welcome, fellow pilgrims, said a man wearing black robes and a beatific smile.
Why, thank you, said Zoya.
Nikolai cast her a warning glance that she happily disregarded.
Are you in charge here?
I am just one more among the faithful.
And you put your faith in the Darkling?
In the saint without stars.
The pilgrim gestured to the gleaming disk of stone. It showed no imperfections, blacker than any night.
Behold the signs of his return.
Zoya ignored the shiver that slid up her spine.
And can you tell me why you worship him?
The man smiled again, clearly elated at the opportunity.
He loved Ravka. He wanted only to make us strong and save us from weak kings.
Weak kings, mused Nikolai.
Almost as vexing as weak tea.
But Zoya was in no mood for nonsense.
He loved Ravka, she repeated.
And what is Ravka? Who is Ravka? All of us, peasant and prince alike.
Of course. Did the Darkling love my aunt, who died beside countless innocent civilians in Novokrybirsk, so that he could show the world his might?
Leave them be, Nikolai murmured, laying a hand on her arm.
She shook him off.
Did he love the girl he forced to commit those murders? What about the girl he tossed into the old king's bed for his own purposes, then mutilated when she dared to challenge him? Or the woman he blinded for failing to offer him unswerving devotion?
Who would speak for Liliana, for Jenya and Alina and Bagra, if she did not?
Who will speak for me? But the pilgrim remained unshaken, his smile steady, gentle, maddening.
Great men are often the victims of the lies told by their enemies. What saint has walked among us who did not face hardships in this life? We have been taught to fear darkness.
A lesson you failed to learn.
But we are all alike in the dark, said the pilgrim. Rich man, poor man.
A rich man can afford to keep the lights on,
Nikolai said mildly. He gave Zoya a hard yank on her arm, dragging her back to the skiff and away from the pilgrims.
Let go of me, she seethed. Where is the shrine to my aunt? To Saint Harshaw? To Sergei? Or Marie? Or Fedyor? Who will worship them and light candles in their names?
She felt the unwelcome prickle of tears in the back of her throat and swallowed them down. These people did not deserve her tears, only her anger.
Zoya, Nikolai whispered. If you keep drawing attention, we may be recognized.
He was right. She knew that. But this place, seeing that symbol on those banners, it was all too much. She whirled on Nikolai.
Why do they love him?
They love strength, he said. Living in Ravka has meant living in fear for so long. He gave them hope.
Then we have to give them something more.
We will, Zoya.
He cocked his head to the side.
I don't like it when you look at me that way. As if you've stopped believing.
All those lives lost. All we've worked for. And these fools are so ready to rewrite history.
She shook her head, wishing she could force out the memories, uproot them forever, You don't know, Nikolai. The battle at the spinning wheel. Seeing Adric's arm torn from his body. His blood. It soaked the deck. We couldn't get it clean. The people we lost here, on these sands, you don't remember. You were the demon then. But I remember it all.
I remember enough, he said.
And there was an edge to his voice she hadn't heard before. He laid his hands on her shoulders, his grip hard.
I remember, Zoya. And I promise I won't let the world forget. But I need you to come back to me. I need my general beside me now.
Zoya drew in a shaking breath, trying to find some calm, to stop the images from coming. Don't look back. Don't look back at me. She saw Liliana's teacup sitting on the counter at her shop, smelled the warm orange scent of bergamot. She couldn't breathe. Her head felt heavy and blurred as she let Nikolai pull her onto the skiff. The junior squalors had already left their post to get a better look at the black stone. No discipline at all. Nikolai signaled to the twins.
Tolia, Tamar. Corral those squalors and get them back here. Then take opposite sides of this big shiny eyesore and walk the perimeter. Find out what you can about when it appeared and how many people come to the site every day. We'll need to deal with them if we actually want to dig nearby. Zoya and I will take the skiff farther west with Yuri. We'll reconvene to decide next steps in an hour's time.
I can help, Yuri protested, watching Tolia and Tamar leap down to the sands. I can talk to the pilgrims.
You'll remain with us. We'll travel a little farther on and decide what to do. I don't know how we're going to dig here without those people getting involved.
Yuri pushed his spectacles up his long nose, and Zoya wanted to break them in two.
Perhaps we should get them involved, he said. Or we could claim we're searching for relics from the battle for a museum.
That may only incense them, said Nikolai. They'll claim the site is holy and can't be touched, or they'll want to dig themselves to locate objects for their altars.
Zoya didn't care what the pilgrims wanted. If she had to look at them and their black banners another minute, she thought she might well lose her mind. She pushed up her sleeves, feeling the weight of the amplifier at her wrist.
Enough politicking, enough diplomacy. They want darkness, I'll give it to them. Zoya, warned Nikolai.
But her anger had slipped its leash, and she could feel the storm rise. All it took was the barest twist of her wrists, and the sand shifted, forming ripples, then dunes, rising higher and higher. She saw Jenya huddled in her black shawl, her arms thick with scars. She saw Harshaw dead in the sand, his red hair like a fallen flag. Zoya's nostrils were full of the scent of bergamot and blood. The wind howled as if it were speaking her rage.
Zoya, stop this, Nikolai hissed.
The pilgrims shouted to one another, taking shelter, huddling together. She liked their fear. She let the sand form shapes, a shining sun, the face of a woman. Liliana's face, though no one there would know it. The wind screamed and the sands rose in a tidal wave, blocking out the sun and plunging the camp into darkness. The pilgrims scattered and ran.
There's your saint, she said with grim satisfaction. Enough, Zoya, said Nikolai in the deep shadow her power had cast. That's an order.
She let the sands drop. A wave of dizziness struck her, and for a moment the world seemed to flicker and warp. Her knees buckled, and she fell hard to the deck of the skiff, frightened by the surge of nausea that had overcome her. Nikolai seized her arm.
Are you?
And then he seemed to stumble too, his eyes rolling back in his head.
Nikolai?
Yuri vomited over the railing.
What just happened? She said, pushing to her feet.
Why?
But the words died on her lips. Zoya turned in a slow circle. The pilgrim camp was gone. The tents, the gleaming stone. The blue sky had bled away to a gray twilight.
Where are Tolia and Tamar? Said Nikolai.
Tolia, Tamar, the squalors, everyone who had been standing near the skiff was gone too.
Where are they?
Yuri said.
What happened to them? What did you do?
I didn't do anything, Zoya protested. It was a little storm. No one was in any danger.
Am I having some kind of episode? Said Nikolai, staring into the distance. Or are you seeing this too?
Zoya turned to the west. Above them loomed a palace, wrought from the same bone-colored sand as the fold. But it was less a palace than a city, a massive structure that rose in arches and peaks, clouds roiling around its highest spires. There was something in its construction, in its sweeping scale, that reminded her of the bridge at Yvette's. A shriek sounded from somewhere in the distance.
Volcra, Zoya thought, though she knew that couldn't be.
It's a miracle, said Yuri, falling to his knees.
Another shriek sounded, then another, and a rumble of thunder followed as dark shapes seemed to break from the palace, moving toward them at an incredible speed.
It's not a miracle, said Nikolai, reaching for his revolvers. It's a trap.
The Witch in the Wood. Chapter 15. Nikolai. Nikolai had seen many astonishing things. The fog ponies of the Zemini frontier, said to be so fast that when they ran, they became invisible. A sea serpent thrashing its way through the northern ice, the world unspooling before him as he rode the winds with the wings of a monster on his back. But his eyes could not make sense of what he saw swooping toward him in the sky. Yuri was on his knees praying. Zoya had her arms raised, and Nikolai could already feel the sand whipping around the skiff as she summoned the wind to their defense. As soon as he'd heard that shriek in the air, Nikolai had drawn his revolvers and prepared to face the Volcra. He had expected shadow monsters or some new embodiment of the Darkling's power. Hell, maybe some part of him had expected the Darkling himself. The Starless Saint resurrected, come to plague them all with charisma and ill intent. Instead, he saw bees, a vast swath of them moving through a sky the color of porridge, shifting and clustering into what might have been the shape of a woman. Behind the swarm, a grotesque loped over the sand, a massive body that kept forming and reforming, two heads, then three, a thousand arms, a humped back with a spine that twisted in sinuous ridges, 10, 20, 30 long, spindly legs moving in tandem. The forms were human one moment, animal the next, thick with fur and gnashing teeth. And there, circling high above, a third monstrosity, wings wide and scales gleaming.
Zoya, say something spiteful.
Why? She asked faintly.
Because I'm fairly certain I'm hallucinating, and in my dreams you're much nicer.
You're an idiot, Nikolai.
Not your best work. I'm sorry, I can't deliver better wordplay right now. I seem to be paralyzed with fear.
Her voice was trembling, and if ruthless, unshakable Zoya was that frightened, then everything he was seeing was real. The bees, the grotesque, and yes, impossible but there nonetheless, the dragon. Vast in size, its arching wings leathery, its scales glinting black, green, blue, gold in the flat gray light.
Zoya, whatever you did to bring us here, this would be the time to undo it.
If I could, I would, she growled, then hurled a wall of wind upward. The bees struck it, like water parting around a rock in a stream, their loud buzz filling Nikolai's ears.
Do something, said Zoya.
Like what?
You have guns. I'm not going to shoot at bees.
Then shoot at that thing.
Nikolai opened fire at the grotesque.
His bullet struck its shifting body. A head, an arm, another arm, a distended chest.
Now that the thing was closer, he glimpsed claws, jaws thick with canines, the dense brown pelt of what looked like a bear. All of his bullets were absorbed in the grotesque's body, then emerged a second later as if the writhing flesh had simply spat them out. High above, the dragon roared and spread its enormous wings. A fountain of flame erupted from the beast's mouth and blasted toward them.
Zoya's hands shot upward, and a dome of air formed over their heads. The flames beat at the barrier. Nikolai could feel the heat singeing his brows. The blast relented, and the dragon shrieked again, wheeling above them.
"I think it's fair to say we're outgunned," said Nikolai. "Lay down your arms," the grotesque said, in a chorus of voices from 100 mouths.
"In a moment," replied Nikolai. "I'm finding them very reassuring right now. Yuri, get off your damned knees and at least try to look like you can fight."
"You don't understand," said Yuri, his eyes full of tears.
"That is entirely correct."
"I'm going to raise the sands again," said Zoya. "If I bring a big enough storm, we'll have cover to get somewhere. You'll need to work the sails. I won't be able to control the storm and direct the skiff."
"Do it," said Nikolai, eyeing the lines.
They were primitive at best, but he had managed rockier seas than these. He opened fire, trying to lend Zoya cover as she swept her arms forward, and the sands of the fold, or wherever they were, rose with a whoosh. There was no subtlety now, no need to mask her actions to fool the pilgrims. Instead, the storm came to life with a start, like a man waking from a bad dream, a sudden wall of force that thrust the creatures back, the sands forming a whirling wall to hide the skiff's escape. Nikolai holstered his revolvers and seized the lines, releasing the sail. The canvas snapped, filling with air, driving them east and back toward what he hoped were still the borders of the fold. Whatever these creatures were, their powers had to be tied to this place. Suddenly, the ground beneath them started to buckle. The skiff listed precariously starboard, as one of its runners peeled away from the sand. Zoya and Yuri lost their footing, but Zoya did not falter. Even on her back, she kept the winds in motion. Nikolai held tight to the lines, trying to use the storm to help right the skiff. But the ground was bucking like a wild animal, as if the very sands beneath them had life. The skiff tilted higher on its single runner.
"We're going over," Nikolai shouted.
He had the uncanny sense that a giant hand was deliberately tipping them out onto the sands. They landed in an unceremonious heap. Nikolai was on his feet in an instant, grabbing for Zoya and Yuri to roll all of them to safety. But the skiff thumped harmlessly down to its side, and the sands instantly calmed. Without Zoya's storm raging, the skies were clear again. A shape emerged out of the sand before them. Then another. A regiment of sand soldiers. They were faceless, but their uniforms were elaborately detailed. They looked like the paintings of ancient Ravkan soldiers, the army of Yaromir the Determined, dressed in furs and bronze, but all of it wrought in sand. Zoya raised her hands and sent a fierce gust of wind slamming into the ranks of soldiers, but they stood solid and unmoving.
"What are they?" Zoya asked.
The soldiers continued to emerge in a rippling wave, an army that stretched to the horizon, where the castle still loomed.
"I think we're being shown just how overmatched we are," Nikolai said.
"By whom?"
The sand soldiers stepped forward as one, and the sound was like a shotgun blast. Zoya and Nikolai stood back to back, surrounded. Next to them, Yuri remained on his knees, his face filled with a kind of manic elation.
"I don't know how to fight this," Zoya said.
She'd somehow steadied her voice, but he could hear the fear in it anyway. "Is this the part where we die well?" The dragon was wheeling overhead. If these creatures wanted Nikolai dead, they'd chosen an elaborate means of making it happen. So something else had to be in play. Hopefully something that would allow him to negotiate for Zoya's and Yuri's safety.
"No, this is the part where the King of Ravka surrenders himself. And the love we never had lives on in ballads and song."
"Nikolai," snapped Zoya. "Don't you dare."
"Give me another option, Nazyalensky. One of us needs to survive this."
Then he lowered his voice.
"Get back to the capital and rally the Grisha."
Assuming she could even get back to Oz Alta from here.
He tossed his revolvers to the sand and raised his hands, scanning the rows of sand soldiers, the figures in the sky, the mountainous body of the grotesque hovering behind their ranks.
I'm not sure who I'm surrendering to.
The dragon turned sharply in the air and dove for them. Maybe they did intend to kill him after all.
Zoya, get down! Nikolai shouted, lunging for her.
Like hell, she muttered, and knocked him into the sands, bracing before him with her feet planted and her arms raised. The dragon unleashed its fire, and Zoya let loose the storm. For a moment they seemed evenly matched, a golden cascade of flame buffeted by a wall of wind. Then Zoya swept her arms in a loop and cast them to the sides like a conductor concluding a symphony. For a moment, Nikolai didn't understand, but then the flames collapsed. The dragon reared back, a choked wheeze emerging from its throat. Zoya had stolen its breath. She banished the air from the fire, depriving it of fuel, and left the dragon gasping. Nikolai leapt for his guns, ready to seize the opportunity she'd offered, but before he could even aim, the dragon released a deafening roar. Its jaws opened, and fire spurted forth. This time, the flame burned blue, brighter and hotter than before, hot enough to melt stone. Or sand.
Zoya!
Nikolai shouted, but Zoya had already fisted her hands and raised them again, driving an icy wind against the dragon's onslaught. Blue fire lit her face, her hair rose like a black crown against her head, and her eyes blazed cobalt as if she too burned with the dragon's fire. Zoya screamed as the dragon's flames pounded against the force of her power. She gritted her teeth and Nikolai saw beads of sweat bloom on her brow. He opened fire on the dragon, but his bullets seemed to melt before they even came near the creature's scales. Ice crystallized on the fallen skiff, coated Nikolai's hands and the ranks of the sand soldiers surrounding them. And then Zoya collapsed. She fell to her knees. And the winter storm evaporated, leaving nothing but a thin shell of melting frost in its wake. Nikolai was on his feet, stumbling toward her, certain he was about to see her consumed by flame, but the dragon withdrew its fire. It hovered in the air, watching.
Zoya,
Nikolai said as he went to his knees beside her, catching her in his arms before she could topple. Her skin was aglow with the light of Grisha power, but her nose was bleeding and she was shaking. The dragon landed before them, folding its vast wings. Perhaps it wanted to play with its food.
Stay back,
Nikolai said, though he had no way of preventing the beast's advance. His weapons were as good as toys. Yori was still on his knees, swaying like a drunk who couldn't decide whether it was worth the effort to try to stand.
The boy king, said the dragon, prowling forward, tail lashing the air.
Its voice was a low rumble, like thunder on a distant peak.
The war hero. The prince with a demon curled inside his heart.
Nikolai wasn't sure if he was more startled that the dragon could speak, or that it knew what had brought them on this cursed journey. The dragon leaned forward. Its eyes were large and silver, its pupils black slits.
If I wanted to harm her, she would be ashes, boy. So would you all.
It sure looked like you wanted to harm her, Nikolai said. Or is that how your kind says a friendly hello?
The dragon rumbled what might have been a laugh.
I wanted to see what she could do.
Zoya released a howl of pure anguish. It was a sound so desperate, so raw, Nikolai could hardly believe it was coming from his general's mouth.
What is it?
He pleaded, his arm tightening around her as he scanned her body for wounds, for blood. But she cast him off, scrabbling in the sand, another wail of rage and pain tearing from her chest.
For saint's sake, Zoya, what's wrong?
She snatched up something that glinted in her hand and clutched it to her chest, her sobs like nothing he had heard before. It took him a moment to force her fingers open. Cradled in her palm, he saw the broken halves of her silver cuff. Her amplifier had shattered.
No,
she sobbed. No.
Yes,
hissed the dragon.
Joris, stop this,
said a woman, emerging from between the rows of soldiers. She wore a dress of blooming roses that blossomed and died in curling vines around her body. Her golden hair was a buzzing mass of bees that swarmed and clustered around her radiant face.
You got your battle. They know what they are facing. The first bit of excitement we've had in years, Elisaveta. And you seem determined to deny me my fun. Very well.
The dragon heaved its shoulders in a shrug, and then before Nikolai's bewildered eyes it seemed to shift and shrink, becoming a towering man in finely wrought chainmail that glittered like black scales. The sand soldiers parted to reveal the grotesque, his body still shifting and changing, now covered in eyes, as if to better take in every inch of them.
What is this? Nikolai demanded. Who are you?
Do the people not pray for saints?
Asked the man called Juris.
At last, wept Yori, still kneeling. At last!
Come, said Elisaveta, extending a hand, the bees buzzing gently around her in a hum that was almost soothing.
We will explain all.
But Nikolai's mind had already leapt a chasm into preposterous territory. Sankt Elisabetta, who had been martyred in a field of roses. Sankt Joris, who...
You slew the dragon, said Nikolai. It's in all of the stories.
Sometimes the stories are rough on the details, said Juris with a gleaming smile. Come, boy king. It's time we talked.
Chapter 16. Isaac. Isaac was trying very hard not to sweat through his uniform, and the effort was only making him sweat more. It was not so much the pain of transformation that bothered him, but the proximity of Jenya Safin as she moved her fingers over the lines of his nose and brow. He'd been sequestered with her for nearly 2 days in a practice room, usually occupied by the Corporalkai. It had no windows, and its single door was always guarded by one of the Batar twins. The light for Jenya's careful work came from the vast skylight above, the glass so clear it could only be Grisha made. Isaac had little to do but stay as still as possible, stare at Jenya, and let his mind wander down the path that had brought him to this incomprehensible situation. Had it begun with his father's passing? With the draft? Had it begun during the northern campaign when he'd served under Nikolai Lansov? His prince had been just past 18, only a few months older than Isaac himself. Isaac had come to admire his commander, not just for his bravery, but for the way he could think himself out of a tight situation. He never forgot a name, never failed to ask after an ailing relative or the progress of a healing wound. After the Battle of Holmhend, the prince had visited the infirmary to speak to the wounded. He had spent hours there, chatting by each soldier's bedside, charming every nurse, raising spirits. When he'd sat down beside Isaac's cot, filled Isaac's water glass, and gone so far as to lift the glass to Isaac's lips so he could drink, Isaac had been so overwhelmed he'd had to remind himself how exactly one swallowed water. They'd talked about Isaac's childhood, his sisters, and Isaac found himself telling the prince all about his father, who had been a tutor in the house of Baron Velchik. Isaac hadn't spoken of his father's death in years, and had never told anyone about how his life had changed in the wake of that tragedy, how his family had been forced to leave the Baron's estate and take up residence in a tiny rented room above a dressmaker's shop, where his mother had done her best to feed and clothe Isaac and his sisters by taking in piecework. The prince had praised Isaac's gift for languages, and suggested he cultivate the talent now that it was time for Isaac to leave the front.
I'm not sure that's something my family can afford,
Isaac had admitted with some shame.
But I will certainly consider it, Your Highness.
He'd returned home and begun to look for work as soon as he was able. Months passed as Isaac took on odd jobs and waited for his body to heal, so that he could return to active duty and the pay his family so desperately needed. Then one evening, he arrived home to find his mother waiting for him with a letter. He'd spent a long day shoveling manure, for which he'd earned all of 6 eggs, which he'd carried home gently cradled in the folds of his shirt. He nearly dropped them all when he saw that the letter in his mother's hand was stamped with the pale blue wax of the prince's double eagle seal.
"Dear Isaac, delighted to see we both survived my leadership. If you'd like to leave your village and make the arduous journey to Olsalta, there's a job waiting for you in the Royal Guard at the Grand Palace. It will require a great deal of standing up straight, not looking bored through the most tiresome events man can conceive, opening doors, and keeping your buttons shiny. So I would not blame you if you'd prefer literally any other occupation. But if you've the courage to face such horrors, you will also find my own tutors happy to school you in the languages of your choosing. I hope you will select Shu, Kirch, and Zemini, as they are the languages that might best serve a prince or a king, but you are certainly welcome to indulge your taste for Kalish poetry. I did, and my stomach's been aching since. With fondest regards, Nikolai Lansoff, Grand Duke of Udova, Prince of Ravka, etc.
Isaac's mother and sisters had gathered round to touch the fine, heavy paper and press their fingers to the tracery of the wax seal. His mother had wept, both because her son was leaving and because the prince had done them this great honor. Positions in the palace guard were usually reserved for war heroes and the sons of lesser noblemen. As for Isaac, he had spent the rest of the week patching holes in the roof that their landlord refused to repair, and when the work was done, he'd kissed his mother and his baby sisters and promised that he would write to them as often as he was able. He'd put on his army boots and his much-darned coat and set out for the capital. Isaac had enjoyed his work at the palace, the quiet of Olsalta after the chaos of war and the hardships of home, the pleasure of learning languages in his off hours. With the wages he sent home every month, his family was able to move into a snug cottage with a garden large enough to grow vegetables and a north-facing window where his mother could easily do her sewing in the sun. It was not always easy. He had known little more than the confines of his small town and the routine of the army, and he was not sure what he found more intimidating. The dishes with their golden filigree, the ladies in their jewels, or simply the sight of Second Army soldiers in their red, blue, and purple kefta moving about the grounds. But in time he'd found his place and adapted to the rhythms and requirements of palace life. When the Darkling had staged his attack on the throne, Isaac had taken up arms to support the Lansoff name. And when Prince Nikolai had become King Nikolai, he'd stood at attention in the newly rebuilt chapel and watched his king crowned with pride in his heart. Life had gone on. Isaac had become fluent in Shu, Zemini, Kirch, and Suli. He earned extra pay working as a translator for the crown, and despite his king's warnings, Isaac developed a taste for poetry of all kinds. Then the summons had come. Isaac had been on duty at the entrance to the southern wing when Tamar Kirbatar had sought him out. Isaac had been confused and more than a little frightened. It was not every day that one was called before the Grisha Triumvirate, though he was relieved to find that Zoya Nazielensky was still traveling with the king, so he could at least avoid her scathing look of disdain. She could wither a man's balls just by raising a brow. He'd spent scant time in the little palace and had never ventured past the Hall of the Golden Dome, but Tamar escorted him through the vast double doors emblazoned with the Triumvirate's bunched arrows, and down winding hallways to a small room lined in elaborate maps of Ravka and the world. Jenya Safin and David Kostick were there, along with Tamar's twin, Tolia, who was so tall his head nearly brushed the ceiling, and whom Isaac occasionally traded volumes of verse with. He was surprised to see both of the twins. At least one could usually be counted upon to be in the company of the king.
"Captain Andreev, won't you sit?" Jenya Safin had asked.
To his astonishment, she'd served him tea and asked after his health, and only then had she said the words that would change the course of his life.
"The king is missing."
The story that followed had been strange indeed, and Isaac knew he was being told only the barest details. King Nikolai and Commander Nazyalensky had been traveling with the Batars when they'd vanished from the sands of the Unsea. Though the twins had searched as extensively as discretion would allow, they'd found no sign of them. "We do not yet know if the king is in need of rescue or beyond it," Jenya said. "But we do know that if our enemies learn of the king's disappearance, they're sure to take advantage of our vulnerability. There is no clear line of succession for the Ravkan throne, and it is essential that no one discover we are without a ruler until the king can be found or a strategy put into play."
"Of course," Isaac murmured, thinking of the panic it would create among the people.
Jenya took a deep breath. "But in 2 weeks' time, 17 princesses, noblewomen, and ladies of worth will arrive in Osalta, surrounded by their servants and retainers, all of them hoping to meet Nikolai Lansov and become Ravka's queen. Unfortunately, we are short one monarch. That is why we need you."
"Me?"
"To play the role of the king." Isaac smiled because he could think of no other way to respond, though he didn't understand the joke, he was willing to play along. But Jenya Safin did not return his smile. "It was a contingency plan the king himself conceived in case he was injured or incapacitated," she said gently, "though we had no reason to think we would need to act on it so soon, or with so little preparation. You were on his list of candidates. You are of approximately the right height. You can speak multiple languages. I believe I can tailor you to look enough like the king that you will be able to fool even the guards who have watched over him for years."
"Sitting still, at least," said Tolia.
"Correct," said Jenya. "Looking like Nikolai will only be the first challenge. Talking like him, walking like him, and all the rest? Well, that would be up to you."
You can't mean for me to pretend to be him," said Isaac. "It was unthinkable, absurd."
"We can," said Tolia, his massive arms crossed. "We do." "Surely the proceedings could be delayed. If the king is meant to choose a queen..."
"The brides could be put off," said Tamar, "but there are matters of national security that cannot. We have intelligence suggesting that a member of the Tav Garad may be ready to defect. This may be our only chance to make contact with her and learn the locations of valued Shu military assets."
Tav Garad. The strict translation was stone-fisted, but Isaac knew the word referred to the elite soldiers who guarded and served the Shu royal family. If one of them was willing to turn traitor, there was no telling what information might be gleaned. Tamar Kir Batar had looked at him with hard golden eyes and said, "Your country needs you." But it had been Jenya, with her scarred mouth, who had swayed him when she added, "And so does your king." Isaac said yes. Of course he had said yes. It was his duty as a soldier, and the least he could do for the king who had done so much for him and his family. So it had begun, the lessons in deportment, in elocution, in how to sit and stand correctly. It was not just that Isaac had to pretend to be a man of wealth and means, he had to pretend to be a king, and not just a king, but a boy king who had become legend. Nikolai was everything that Isaac was not. Confident, assured, cosmopolitan. Isaac's only gift was a faculty with language, and even that had become something of a liability since he spoke Shu better than the king and had a cleaner Zemini accent. But the strangest of all these processes was the time he'd spent here, beneath this glass dome, sweating through his clothes in the presence of Jenya Safin with her single amber-colored eye and her sunset hair. Though Isaac knew she was only performing a task, it was hard not to feel that she was studying him, lavishing her attention upon him. And he'd found himself falling a bit in love with her. It was a silly infatuation. She was clearly in love with David Caustic, the brilliant fabricator, who sat silently through many of their sessions, reading from stacks of documents and scribbling on a giant tablet of drafting paper. But her apparent taste for unassuming men made him like her all the more. One of her scars tugged the left corner of her mouth down slightly, and he would catch himself daydreaming about kissing her there. He was rapidly brought back to reality by the sharp poke of her finger to his shoulder. "Sit up straight, Isaac," she would say, or, "You are blocking my light, Isaac." Sometimes the others came to read to him from a book on Kirch history or quiz him on trade routes while Jenya worked. Other times they talked strategy, and he was expected to do nothing but sit there like a lump of clay.
"We can sneak him out of the palace through the tunnels after dark," Tamar said, twirling one of her axes in a way that made Isaac sweat even more. "Then stage the king's return from his pilgrimage the next morning. It will look like he just made a stop at Count Kerrigan's estate."
"How do we account for Zoya's absence?"
Tolia asked. Jenya leaned back to examine the work she was doing on Isaac's chin.
"We'll say she stayed behind to journey to Oskervo."
She rubbed her eyes and reached for her teacup.
"I don't understand it. No one just vanishes."
"Leave it to Nikolai to do the impossible," said Tolia.
"Maybe he just wanted a vacation," said Tamar. Tolia grunted.
"Maybe Zoya finally got sick of him and buried him beneath a pile of sand."
But Jenya did not laugh.
"Or maybe this was the apparat's doing, and he's back in the business of staging coups."
"If that's the case," said David, "he'll come for us next."
"Thank you, my love. That's very encouraging."
Tamar slowed the twirling of her axe.
"If the apparat orchestrated this, I'd have to expect him to make a move to expose the king's disappearance by now."
"Either way," said Tolia, "we'll have to keep him away from Isaac. The priest is too canny not to realize the king isn't himself."
Jenya slumped down in a chair and rested her head in her hands. Isaac had never seen her look so defeated, and it hurt his heart.
"Who are we kidding? This isn't going to work."
"It will," said Tamar. "It has to."
"He's already almost identical to the king," said David, peering at Isaac's face. "I'd say it's your best work."
Jenya cast away the compliment with a wave of her hand.
"It's not just the features. It's the way Nikolai inhabits them. The tilt of his mouth, the cant of his head. We might fool the guests, maybe even a few of the courtiers. But the servants, the royal ministers, people who see him every day, who have dined with him and danced with him, forget it. This is hopeless."
"I'm sorry," Isaac said.
He hated to think he was failing his country and his king, as well as the talented girl before him. Jenya threw up her hands.
"That's what I mean. Nikolai would never lower his head that way or apologize with such sincerity."
"I'm sorry,"
Isaac said again without thinking, and then winced. "We're out of options," said Tamar. "We cancel the party and risk Nikolai's absence being discovered, or we take this risk."
"And if we're found out?"
Tolia asked.
"I'm not even sure what we'd be guilty of," considered David. "Is impersonating a king treasonous if you're doing it for the king's benefit?"
Isaac swallowed. Treason? He hadn't even thought of that.
"We could be handing the apparat an easy way to eliminate all of the Grisha leadership in a single move," said Tamar.
Jenya released a sigh.
"Isaac, I know you're doing your best, but we've asked too much of you. This was madness from the start."
Isaac hated to see these brave people lose hope. He remembered Nikolai Lantzoff, perched beside his infirmary bed, thought of his mother's smile and his sister's plump cheeks the last time he'd returned home. He leaned back, draped an arm over the top of his chair, and said with all the easy, drawling arrogance he could summon,
"Jenya, my love, ring for brandy. I can't be expected to tolerate certain doom when I'm this sober."
They stared at him. David tapped an ink-stained finger to his lips.
"Better?"
"Better?"
cried Jenya, clapping her hands with glee. It was perfect. Do it again. Isaac felt a moment's panic, then arched a brow.
Are you giving me orders now? I hope this means I can indulge in a kingly nap.
Tamar grinned. Tolia whooped. Jenya leaned down and pressed a huge kiss to Isaac's cheek. And Isaac did what Nikolai Lamsov never would have done. He blushed.
Chapter 17. Nikolai. The skiff was abandoned, and the sands carried Nikolai, Zoya, and Yuri to the giant palace, the dunes sliding beneath their feet in a way that made Nikolai's stomach lurch. He prided himself on adapting easily, but it was one thing to implement a new technology, adopt a new fuel, or dare to wear shirt sleeves at dinner without a waistcoat. It was quite another to see your understanding of the natural world smashed to bits in an afternoon.
You look unwell, boy king, rumbled Joris, who had resumed his dragon form.
A novel means of transport. I don't suppose you'd consider carrying us on your back.
The dragon huffed.
Only if you'd like to return the favor.
Nikolai had to crane his neck to take in the palace as they approached. He'd never seen a structure so vast. It would have taken a regiment of engineers working for 1,000 years to imagine such a creation, let alone see it built. The palaces and towers were clustered around 3 major spires, one of black stone, one of what looked like glowing amber, and one of what could only be bone. But there was something wrong about the place. He saw no signs of life, no birds circling, no movement at the many windows, no figures crossing the countless bridges. It had the shape of a city, but it felt like a tomb.
Is there no one else here? He asked.
No one,
said the shifting grotesque in a chorus of baritone voices punctuated by the growl of a bear.
Not for almost 400 years.
400 years? Nikolai looked to Zoya, but her gaze was distant, her hand clasped around her bare left wrist. The sand rose, lifting them higher, and Nikolai saw that the 3 spires surrounded a domed structure, a mass of terraces and palaces and waterfalls of cascading sand that shimmered in the gray twilight. They passed beneath a large arch and into a wide circular chamber, its walls glinting with mica. The sand beneath their feet became stone, and a round table swelled up from the floor, its center a milky geode. Elizaveta gestured for them to sit in the stone chairs that emerged beside it.
I fear we can offer you no food or drink, she said.
We'll settle for answers, said Nikolai.
Yuri knelt on the stone floor, his head bowed, nattering in what Nikolai thought was liturgical Ravkin, since he could only pick out an occasional word, promised, foretold, darkness.
Please stop that, Elizaveta said, her bees humming in distress. And please, sit.
Leave him be. He's abasing himself and enjoying it, said Juris.
He folded his wings and settled onto the floor a good distance from Yuri.
Where to begin?
Custom dictates we start with, who the hell are you?
I thought we'd already covered that, boy king.
Yes, but sainthood requires martyrdom. You all look very much alive, unless this is the afterlife, in which case I am sorely underdressed. Or overdressed. I suppose it depends on your idea of heaven.
Does he always talk this much?
Joris asked Zoya. But she said nothing, just gazed up at the flat expanse of colorless sky above them.
We all died at one time or another, and were reborn, said Elizaveta. Sometimes not quite as we were.
You can call us what you like, Grisha. Saints.
Relics, said Joris.
Elizaveta pursed her lips.
I don't care for that term at all.
Yuri released a small ecstatic sob.
All is as was promised,
he babbled. All I was told to hope for...
Elisaveta sent a vine curling over his shoulder, like a comforting arm.
That's enough, she said gently. You're here now and must calm yourself.
Yori grasped at the vine, pressed his face into the leaves, weeping. So much for the great scholar.
Where are we exactly? Nikolai asked.
In the Shadow Fold,
said one of the mouths of the grotesque, who had introduced himself as Grigori. Sankt Grigori. If Nikolai recalled correctly, he'd been torn apart by bears, although that hardly explained his current condition.
A version of it. One we cannot escape.
Does any of this matter? Zoya said dully. Why bring us here? What do you want?
Juris turned his slitted eyes on her, his tail moving in a long, sinuous rasp over the floor.
Look how the little witch mourns, as if she knew what she had lost or what she stands to gain.
Nikolai expected to see Zoya's eyes light with anger, but she just continued to stare listlessly at the sky. Seeing her this way, devoid of the spiky, dangerous energy that always animated her, was more disturbing than any of the bizarre sights they'd encountered. What was wrong with her? Had the amplifier meant so much? She was still strong without it. She'd be strong with both arms tied behind her back and a satchel of lead ball bearings weighing her down.
I wish we could have brought you elsewhere, young Zoya, said Elisaveta. We had power before the word Grisha was ever whispered, when the extraordinary was still called miracle and magic. We have lived lives so long, they would dwarf the history of Ravka. But this place, this particular spot on the fold, has always been holy, a sacred site where our power was at its greatest and where we were most deeply connected to the making at the heart of the world. Here, anything was possible. And here we were bound when the Darkling created the fold.
What? Zoya asked, a spark of interest at last entering her eyes.
We are woven into the fabric of the world in a way that no other Grisha are, the threads tightened by years and the use of our power. When the Darkling tampered with the natural order of the world, we were drawn here. And when his experiment with Merzost failed, we were trapped within the boundaries of the fold.
We cannot leave this place, said Grigori. We cannot assume physical form anywhere but here.
Physical form, Juris sneered and thumped his tail.
We don't eat, we don't sleep. I don't remember what it is to sweat or hunger or dream. I'd chop off my left wing just to hear my stomach growl or taste wine again, or take a piss out a window.
Must you be so vulgar?
Elisaveta said wearily.
I must, said Juris. Making you miserable is my sole entertainment.
Grigori settled into the shape of what looked like three bear heads topping the body of a single enormous man and folded two sets of arms.
We endured this endless twilight because we believed our purgatory would end with the Darkling's death. He had many enemies, and we hoped he might have a short life. But he lived on. And on,
grumbled Juris.
He survived and became nearly as powerful as one of us,
said Grigori. The dragon snorted.
Don't flatter him.
Well, as one of us in our youth, amended Elisaveta. Then at last the time came when the fold was destroyed and the Darkling was slain. And yet our bonds did not break. We remained prisoners. Because the Darkling's power lives on in you.
Nikolai's brows rose.
So, naturally, I must die. This is all very civilized, but if you wanted to murder me, why not get on with it during the battle?
Joris snorted again, steam billowing from his huge nostrils.